Good morning, church. I think we're making this a bit of a regular event. I think this is possibly the third Anzac Day I've preached. So I think last time we were talking about King David. We're not talking about King David today. We're talking about Jeremiah. And Joy, I didn't doubt you at all. I just know that it's tricky. And having spent time in the Air Force Cadets, we had a young guy there called Ute Dewilligan. And was always very funny when we go down to Pierce Air Force Base and some new instructors began to read the roll and they'd come to this name. And we just called him Wheelbarrow. It was a lot easier that way. Now, although it's me preaching again, it nearly wasn't me. You nearly had Julie delivering the sermon. I've had a cold in the last week. I've had the COVID test. You're all relatively safe. And today I get to start the series on the book of Jeremiah. Now I get to break ground here. And for our church, the theme this year is Living Kingdom. And the book of Jeremiah fits this in a most striking way. And so we're going to engage with that and we're going to look at that in a moment. Who heard the title of the sermon beforehand? I left the last little kicker at the end off, in case anybody had seen it and looked it up and read the story in advance. Had anybody seen the title about the Jeremiah chapter 1, Mark chapter 1? And I left it as the gold cigarette case. I didn't leave the last clue. Who knows who Stanley Bruce is? Yes. Yes. The first one. In the video we'll watch later on, it'll say the only one to have. That dates the video for us, doesn't it? Funnily enough, he lost his seat through an industrial relations issue as well. So there you go. Anyway, let me try and see if I can get this to work. Hey, there we go. Prophets are often classified in their relationship to the exile. You have pre-exilic prophets. They talk about the exile that is to come. You have post-exilic prophets. They've talked about what has happened and how we have found ourselves here. And you have exilic prophets who talk about this is what it's like right now. And then you have Jeremiah. Jeremiah is the prophet that doesn't fit those categories. And you can see that in that diagram there. Jeremiah spans pre and during. And from that point of view, he's quite unique in what he covers and how he covers that. As you go through it, you begin to see that he writes about this warning of exile and during the exile itself, just what's going on. Now, when you begin to read Jeremiah chapter 1, that becomes quite clear. The words of Jeremiah, son of Hilkiah, to one of the priests of Anaroth, in the territory of Benjamin, the word of the Lord came to him in the 13th year of the reign of Josiah, son of Amon, king of Judah, and through the reign of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah, down through the fifth month of the 11th year of Zedekiah, son of Josiah, king of Judah, when the people of Jerusalem went into exile. Okay, so he has gone back and written this introduction, because it's talking about something that has occurred. The rest of the chapter, however, reads differently. It reads in an unusual way. It reads in a sense that the story is yet to happen. Get yourself ready. Stand up and say whatever I command you. Do not be terrified by them, or I will terrify you before them. Today I have made a fortified city, an iron pillar and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, against the king of Judah and its officials, its priests and the land. They will fight against you, but they will not overcome you, for I am with you and will rescue you, declares the Lord. That looks like something that is about to happen. So he's talked about something that has happened, and now he's talking about something that is about to happen. And if you find that happens regularly when you're reading Jeremiah and you're a little bit confused, that's why. That pre and during, that mixture that you get in Jeremiah. So there's a weird immediacy and a looking back over your shoulder all at the same time as you go through Jeremiah. From a preaching point of view, doing it as a series, it's tricky because it doesn't pack out nice and neatly. It doesn't move relatively with ease. So that's going to be fun for everybody trying to preach this as we go through. What I like is this as well. I found this. Are you familiar with Cliff Notes? You're not going to be able to read that, but I'll read that for you. Cliff Notes, little summaries for students who are having to study a particular topic. You know, like you might get Cliff Notes on Macbeth or Cliff Notes of the Summer of the Seventh Dole, all of that type of stuff. Well, this is the Cliff Notes on Jeremiah. In the period which Jeremiah worked was one of the most critical in Hebrew history. His public ministry began during the reign of Josiah and lasted until sometime after the fall of Jerusalem and the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. He encountered strong opposition from King Jehoiakim and King Zedekiah, and on more than one occasion his life was threatened. After the fall of Jerusalem, the Babylonians permitted him to remain in his homeland. Many of his fellow countrymen were taken into captivity. Later, he was taken to Egypt against his will by a group of exiles who found it necessary to flee Jerusalem for their own safety. In Egypt, and I underlined this part myself, Jeremiah died after a long and troublesome career. Now, I reckon that would be a very interesting epitaph to have on one's tombstone. Here lies X after a long and troublesome career. I thought of inserting a joke there and maybe referencing Peter. Here lies Peter after a long and troublesome career, but my wife told me that would be unkind and not to do that. I referenced it. I didn't say anything, did I? Now, how is this a living kingdom? If that's the theme that we're going on this year in church, how is this story of exile and pre-exile and during exile, how's it got anything to do with the concept of a living kingdom? Well, in Jeremiah, we step in right at a fulcrum point, right at a change. Here we have Judah itself being broken apart and remade. You don't get any more living kingdom than that. And as we begin to read the rest of the passage, it's really not surprising that he talks about Jeremiah and Jeremiah's call as being knit together in the womb and how it looks forward looking. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I was set apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. It's not surprising, too, that it also shows a foreknowledge of God and the calamity that's about to happen. The Lord said to me, from the north disaster will be poured out on all who live in the land. For I'm about to summon the people of the northern kingdoms, declares the Lord. Their kings will come and set up their thrones in the entrance of the gate of Jerusalem. I will come against her surrounding walls and against the towns of Judah. I'll pronounce my judgment on the people because of their wickedness in forsaking me, in burning incense to other gods, and in worshipping what their hands have made. That last bit is why we are where we are at. How is any of that good news? How does chapter 1, this prophecy, be good news? Jeremiah starts with, this is what has happened. We are in exile. And then he moves to step back in time, and this is how we got here. As part of the covenant relationship between God and Judah, there were roles and responsibilities. God would undertake certain things. He'd be their God, provide land, descendants, a blessing, and make his people a treasured possession. That's God's part of the deal. Judah's part of the deal, certain things, certain roles and responsibilities. Live by God's commandments, have no other gods other than Yahweh. And they didn't do that. Burning incense to other gods, worshipping what their hands have made, they've defaulted on the contract. Judah breaking this covenant has consequences. And that's going to be a big theme when we get to Jeremiah chapter 11. Now remember, nobody likes an I told you so. Guess what Jeremiah's job was? It was to be an I told you so. That's why I think he has that epitaph of dying after a long and troublesome career. This is why Jeremiah didn't make friends. from that point of view. Essentially, how is any of that good news? What is the positive elements in that trouble? Well, Jeremiah doesn't leave it at that point. It moves on. There is a remaking, there is a rebirth in this living kingdom. There is a message that will unfold as a sermon series unfolds. And we're going to get there, and on the 23rd of May, there's some really impressive stuff going to happen in Jeremiah chapter 18. And I've got some spoilers for you, so those who don't want to, you know, find out how it ends can stop listening now and tune out. But essentially, God promises restoration, and Jeremiah is about a new covenant, a new agreement between God and his people. And you're going to be able to see all of that in 31 and 32. And all of that is to coming. So you see how we teeter on this remaking, this remoulding, this redevelopment. It's messy, but it's great. Now, I was thinking about failure and I was thinking about loss and how important that is in reshaping us and our own personal stories. Recently, I've been doing what I call slow reading in my devotions. I've been working through the book of Mark, and the way that that works is I read a chapter a day working through it, and then I go back and I read a segment at a time, and I read the segment and then I write notes for that segment. So I call that slow reading. I do a devotional practice for a period of time, then I change to something else. Well, I'm in the process of doing the slow reading of Mark, and I'm up to the bit where I'm moving segment by segment. I've just recently gone through chapter 6. Now, chapter 6 starts with Jesus being questioned and being rejected in his hometown. And then Jesus goes from village to village, calling the 12 and getting them to preach. And then we have the story of John the Baptist being beheaded. And we have Jesus feeding the 5,000. And then we have this. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to Bethsaida. While he dismissed the crowd, after leaving them, he went up on the mountainside to pray. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. And he saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." He climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. It struck me how different that story would have been if the disciples had been successful. Read it, and the disciples strain at the oars and the wind, but they overcome and they get to the other side. Hooray! Not much of a story. And there's something worse than that. There's a kicker. They would not have been amazed, and their hearts would have still been hardened. They wouldn't have got it. As you read that, it's talking in the past tense. They would have not been amazed. Their hearts would have still been hard. They wouldn't have known who this Jesus was. There's still a long way to go, but this was one of those turning points. Now, you're wondering, why isn't Peter turning up in this particular story? Well, I'm slow reading Mark. It's not one of the other Gospels that I'm slow reading, and we don't have that passage. And I was chatting about this with Dave, and Dave was like, yeah, this concept of defeat. Like, imagine if Peter had been successful. I'm like, yes, I'm not going to talk about that in this sermon because I'm only talking about Mark because that's what I was reading, but it's a super valid point. If Peter had been successful, managed to walk on the water, what would have that done to him? It doesn't bear really thinking about. This small story echoes in some ways the necessity of failure in the making, breaking and remaking of Judah. That's what the exile story is about. It's about building a new covenant by making change. Now here, loss and defeat as nation building should be of no surprise to us as Australians and no surprise on Anzac Day. Did I do that? Did you do that? You did that. Excellent. Great. I'm like, how did I manage to do that? By just the power of my thought. This is the gold cigarette case that belongs to Stanley Bruce. Federation happens in 1901. Gallipoli happens just some 14 years later. The myth of Anzac and the Gallipoli campaign mark the beginning of a philosophical and psychological change for the nation of Australia. It's the beginning of a separation and a coalescing of national identity, a moving away from the concept of empire. How different for us as a nation would it have been if Gallipoli was a success? And some people talk about it almost being so, but I've read plenty of articles and historians on either side of that, and that's a whole different story that we won't go into today. No doubt, at least, we wouldn't have had this gold cigarette case. We wouldn't have had a military loss at Gallipoli. We wouldn't have had a political loss at Canberra. And we wouldn't have had the amazing nation-building development that this gold cigarette case is testament to. Now, because you've been good, I've got a reward for you, and it's a video. And I'll let Warren Brown tell you all about the cigarette case. If it works. With the sound.
Stanley Melbourne Bruce was Australia's 8th Prime Minister. That was back in the 1920s, the racy, roaring 20s. But none of that was for Stanley. Cartoonists of the day loved making fun of his old-fashioned appearance, and they really loved his spiffy spats. But that only made Stanley more determined to wear them. He was his own man. He was also a World War I hero. He received the Military Cross and the French Croix de Guerre. But his most treasured possession wasn't those bravery medals. Prime Minister Bruce's treasure is here at the National Archives of Australia in Canberra. It's something you don't see much nowadays. It's a gold cigarette case, and that's why I have my special white gloves on. When I pick it up, if you have a look at the front of it, you can see it's been engraved with a sort of exotic Middle Eastern design, and in the very centre is a stylized letter B. When I open it up, you can see there's an engraving in here that says 20 Temmuz. Now, Temmuz is Turkish for July 1936, but more importantly, here's the name of the man who gave him this cigarette case, K. Atatürk. That's Kemal Atatürk, who's the first president of modern Turkey. So what do these two blokes have in common? Well, after he left politics, Bruce was a top international diplomat. In 1936, he chaired a League of Nations conference that restored Turkey's naval access to the strategic Dardanelles Straits, which made Atatürk a very happy president. This precious cigarette case was his way of saying thanks to Bruce. But Bruce and Atatürk had another connection involving the Dardanelles. 21 years earlier, in 1915, they both fought there at Gallipoli. Atatürk's troops stopped the Australian forces at Anzac Cove, which made him a national hero. And he was in charge at Suvla Bay, and that's where our bloke, Captain Bruce, earned his bravery medals fighting for the British. And it gets better. Gallipoli pretty much launched both their political careers. Bruce campaigned as a returned war hero, and Atatürk went from soldier to statesman just 5 years after the war. You see, Atatürk became president of Turkey in 1923. Now, that's the very same year Stanley Melbourne Bruce took over as Prime Minister of Australia. Isn't that the most extraordinary coincidence? In his 6.5 years as PM, Bruce forged the Conservative coalition that still exists and oversaw Parliament's move from Melbourne to Canberra in 1927. So Bruce had the honour of being the first PM to sit here in what is now called Old Parliament House. But 2 years later, he had another dubious honour. he became the only PM to lose his seat while in office. Well, so far anyway. But Bruce continued to serve Australia for many years as a highly respected diplomat in Britain and Europe. But the question is, why was a man whose achievements saw him become Viscount Bruce, a peer of the realm, so attached to Ataturk's simple gift? Maybe the case itself holds a clue. I want to show you this. On the back is a design, it's a 10-pointed star, but if you look closely, it's actually 2 5-pointed stars interlocked. Now, as a bit of a war buff, I can tell you that the 5-pointed star is a very important military symbol, and it's also closely associated with Turkish culture. So maybe this was Ataturk's way of saying that somehow he and Bruce were kindred spirits. Bruce clearly thought they were. You see, he had only 2 photographs in his study. One was of his wife, but the other was of Kemal Ataturk, the soldier turned statesman who gave him this gold engraved cigarette case, which makes it one of our national treasures.
We can turn the sound down on that now, even if you can't stop it. Isn't it amazing, the 2 linkages between those 2 stories and how that goes forward? That's not what I'm talking about, but I do find that very interesting. What I find that fits what we're talking about here is, for Stanley Bruce, the breaking down and remaking of him in terms of his political career and the impact that he has. In some ways, he has probably the most important work. Hello. Stop, Nathan's preaching. It's in that defeat that he probably has some of the most significant work that he does. He's known for a speech that he gives, by the historian that deals with the League of Nations. He's known by when he first goes and starts to be involved in that work, by a particular speech he gives about disarmament, saying it's not just for pacifists and it's not just for people that are soft about all of this. It's the people that are most strongly about this are people that have actually been involved directly in conflict. And this is what he's known about. If it's the prayer from before. He's also known for his work in relation to nourishment, nutrition, and a whole lot of stuff in relation to that. Food supply and food security, another big issue between the wars. Significant stuff that he seeks to work on. And this, the access for Turkey through the Dardanelles. Some of his most successful work, significant work, important work, occurs in this period after that process of defeat, that remaking of him politically. In the same way, I think for Australia, Gallipoli defines for us who we are in a way that a victory probably would not have. Tobruk. A victory for Australia, significant one actually, doesn't define us quite in the same way as Gallipoli does, a defeat. As we go through Jeremiah, we see that God engages with pain. God engages with failure. God engages with sin and disobedience. God engages with broken promises, and he breaks down, recasts, and recreates. He makes something new. Exile provides a really, really special opportunity. The opportunity for restoration. The gospel we live is one of restoration, where God meets us through Christ in our brokenness, offers restoration for us in ways that he has foreseen in advance. I encourage you to spend time this week reflecting on who you are in your relationship with the Lord and how it is that he has made you, how it is that he has knit you together in the womb of your life's experiences. And be thankful.